You're listening to Mac Talk on the All Warrior Radio Network. Here on the west coast of the United States on a Wednesday hump day, and the Marine Corps Gazette Hour, so we're a little bit late for that, and we're going to talk about infantrymen on bikes and things like that. So rejoining us, a return engagement, is a prolific writer. Yeah, not just a normal writer, a prolific writer. And, again, gracious enough was on with us last week to rejoin us this week. And so there was a piece of breaking news that caught my attention, so I was checking that out. I'm sorry. Joining me is Major Type, John Kivlin. So, John, first of all, thanks for joining us, and a return engagement. Quite the media personality these days.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me on, Mac. It's great to be on again. Yeah, I don't know if anything about me is prolific, but yeah, I love to speak.
That's not a bad thing. Talk to me first of all. Let's do about a 60-second update on you. Born and raised where?
Albany, New York.
All right. Go to college where?
Actually, I enlisted in the Marine Corps for about 10 years, and I was about 5 years into that. Got into the BOOS/MESAP program, and then ended up going to college at Norwich University.
Okay. And you were a MAGTAP planner, which means he's a smart guy. And then he comes back in the Marine Corps as a grunt, which makes you question whether he truly was a smart guy or not. And so you're now pursuing a career as an infantry officer, yes?
That's correct.
All right. And so we talked about, we had you on last week. We talked about the issue of suppressors on weapons. And so we're going to talk about light infantry problems and bicycle-borne solutions. So, but before we do that, I have to ask you because it's a topic of the week, and it'll certainly your thoughts on all of this Marines United stuff. Let me just your general thoughts on it.
You know, we spoke about this a little bit last week. I mean, it's awful. I think General Milstead hit the nail on the head with the last program he had. Where the commandant, he already seems to be doing it, but we just need to crush this criminal activity and crush those involved, just like everything. It's unfortunate, most unfortunate for the women it affects, but it's secondary to that. It's just such a distraction from the stuff that we are actually supposed to be doing as a Marine Corps, and it's distracting the commandant from focusing on the Marine Corps and you know, dealing with Congress. So just all in all, it's just one of those things that, again, as General Mill said, we'll hit it, crush it, and then move past it to the next kind of crisis at hand.
All right. I'm curious. You've grown up in both Marine Corps. I grew up in a Marine Corps where I never worked with women, you know, my entire career. I didn't work with them. As a MAGTAP planner, you did. Do you have an opinion about the root of this problem? Is it simply what's accepted in society? Unless we, you know, go to greater lengths to stamp it out, you're going to get it in the Marine Corps. What's the issue?
I think, again, kind of echoing the sentiments from the last program, you guys hit the nail on the head. It's a problem with society. And it can get amplified that we deal with 18 to 22 year old, for the most part, alpha males who sometimes make bad, aggressive, just, you know, irresponsible decisions. And it's, you know, it's the small percentage that do that obviously results in a great distraction. But, I think kind of like as you alluded to, it's definitely a problem in society as a whole. And we as Marines, we know that we should be above that, and it's not part of our ethos of who we are. So, again, I would say that we just have to treat it like criminal activity and ruthlessly go after it and root out those who committed the offenses. It's just a terrible thing overall.
Okay.
Can't imagine.
Let me ask you a question about young Marines. Do we need a specific article of the UCMJ to amplify the message, or because it seems like there is a little bit of gap there? Do you have an opinion about that?
I don't know. Obviously, I'm more well-read on the articles than most people. I just don't know why I've nerded out a few times looking for what is actual laws and what's not law. For that specifically in social media, I think it's probably covered under some of the other articles, the Article 134, obviously, kind of the catch-all article gets
right.
It. But I don't know that – I guess maybe actually I thinking about it right now on the spot and without having put a lot of critical thought, maybe there probably it is time to add some kind of article to capture social media. Maybe the character of society has changed enough that we do need to kind of at least refine some of the old articles or add a new article.
Yeah, interesting. I going through Article 120, Charlie, talks about kind of Peeping Tom stuff and stealing these. But as you said, our society has changed. The vast majority of these images, my understanding is they're not stolen. They were, sent consensually with the expectation of privacy. And so that to me is a little bit different in terms of how you receive it. But ultimately, I think to weaponize that, with personal data, I mean, certainly is a crime. I don't know. I just think it needs to be more blunt for young people that come from a society where this happens all the time. And
yeah, absolutely.
I guess in terms of message sending, Article 121 in the Uniform Code of Military Justice says this relative to, does everybody understand that? And then, as you said, crush them. All right, let's talk about, give me the genesis for your article relative to this particular article. Where did this come from?
The genesis of that article is actually based on the other article that was published this month for the On 21st Century Warfare. The premise is that I don't really believe that we'll have things like 7 tons, we'll have things like tanks, artillery in support of us much longer, and what you can carry is what you can carry. So as in the bicycle article, a lot of people, it's been a little bit since I reviewed it. Again, these things take 4 to 6 months
right.
to get in the Gazette. But a lot of guys they picture themselves in the WASH system at range 400 where seems like every time you talk about doing a conventional attack, all of us put our minds on range 400 there at McCaxey, and we're sitting there in a trench, and we ask ourselves the question of, like, well, how do bicycles help me here? How do bicycles and carts, assist me in this attack? And kind of, as I said in the article, they don't really help you too much. And maybe the carts help you get some ammunition or heavier weapons up to the top of Machine Gun Hill a little bit quicker with a little bit more ease, but ultimately they don't help us. But that's not the TNR standard that the Commandant holds us to. He holds us to walking 12 or 20 miles. So the question is, if when we go to ITX, we were to do the range 400 attack, but instead of starting in the WASH system at 07, if it was 02 and you started at Camp Wilson and you knew you had 12 to 15 miles ahead of you with all those heavy weapons, all of your ammunition, all of the medical, everything thrown, all your breaching equipment, and if your job was to move for 5 hours straight along the road and you were to ask yourself, well, how do bicycles and carts help now? I think most company commanders would be like, oh, if I'm honest with myself, they're like instrumental to my attack to bring the extra ammunition and supplies I need to support this attack for the 15 miles up to when I get in the WASH system. That's kind of where I see them, not as something where obviously you're not attacking on a bicycle in the assault, but it's really like, how do we get from the assembly area to the attack position with all of our supplies and everything that we need to get there, heavier radios and just all the massive amounts of weight that we carry.
All right. Let's talk about that. So explain to me the intellectual premise of the trucks are going away. What makes the trucks go away?
So let me talk about that actually first. So in the article that was published this month, which was kind of the premise for most of my articles on 21st century warfare, a guy, myself and one of my really good friends, Travis Onischuk, he co-wrote it with me. And it goes back to reading Bruce Goodmanson's got his three books on tanks, on artillery, and on infantry that he co-wrote, or he kind of wrote an update edition with John English. And so in on artillery, he talks.
Yeah, I was going to say on infantry, Goodmanson didn't write that. Did he have the balls to like cover English's book? Because English's book is a classic. So forgive me for not knowing.
Him and John English wrote the latest version. So he went and updated that book with John English. I think added some more of the recent developments. And when I say recent, last 20 or 30 years, I think the book. I want to say it's 2004, 2005, but I have to go back and look at that when he did the update to it. But he models on artillery and on tanks. Goodmanson models off of those, and he does. He's one of my favorite people when you're just talking about intellectually, like looking at the Marine Corps and trying to investigate where things started. And I think he ties a lot of the stuff he did to. Like the German penetration tactics of World War One in his book Stormtroop Tactics, but he, as you stated, John English wrote the initial one, and then I think Bruce Goodmanson in the rewrite added like stuff he worked in the last chapter of that book. I suspect he put this in, but he talks about these enhanced fiber optic guided missiles, where if I was to describe a fiber optic missile quickly, it's basically a tow missile, but instead of having the optic, you know, on the system, and you fire the missile, and you track from your position with your optic and steer the missile into it. For fiber optic guided missiles, the optic is in the missile head, and you have a fiber optic connection that's generally about 200 megabits per second. So you're getting super HD capability, and the missile goes downrange, and instead of being stuck where you are. You physically, your observation gets closer and closer to the target until, if you watch some of the videos online, you're actually looking at the SL-3 Pioneer gear on the tank as the missile strikes it. So the big capability there is it's wire guided still through fiber optics, and the optics go with the missile, which allows you to do a lot more stuff that you can't do with the tow missile, like indirect fire. You could fire a volley 2 or 3 kilometers away, and as you're going there, you look, observe with thermal optics, and you can start to see heat signatures. And as you get closer and closer, you can steer this missile into whatever you want to, whatever's the most optimal target, whether it's a platoon of tanks, but then maybe as you're getting closer to destroy the lead tank, you see a circle of individuals in the middle of these tanks where clearly they're around a terrain model, and you put the missile right in the center of that circle and then send a volley of more to take care of the tank. So just allows you to do a lot of stuff. But going back to the first part of that, Bruce Goodmanson, in his book on artillery, talks about the history, or he talks about the Great Divorce, and it's basically somewhere about 1900 when you get rapid-firing artillery, it generally gets too dangerous for artillery pieces to be in the front lines with the infantry. And so Germans and British guys, about the same time, they kind of developed these indirect fire tactics. And from about 1900 on, you see this huge delay in fires because it's either an RDFO or an infantry and who's got to kind of describe the target, describe where the target is, and he's communicating that back there, and then there's the fire line. So there's this, again, as Goodmanson calls it, the great divorce between, you know, maneuver and fire, where you have all this time, and it's not as responsive as it was prior to that in kind of Napoleonic and Civil War era.
So that's the premise. That's the premise.
Yeah, exactly.
So now, why? So fiber optic is critical because of the inability to jam it and countermeasure it.
Exactly. So when you fire even a tow missile, there's limited probably electromagnetic spectrums you can get back, but they're insignificant compared to everything else. It's not transmitting anything. But when you look at firing a fiber optic guided missile, the controls are they're internal to the actual observer who's probably got a laptop or some type of screen there with a control stick. and the missile is being controlled by a little piece of fiber optic cable that's trailing out of the missile. Missile goes about, I think most of the designs, about 200 meters per second. So that missile's flying, and it's not flying in a ballistic trajectory, and it's not emitting any electromagnetic signal, which is problematic for a lot of reasons. I can't figure out, even if I do take a missile, I don't know through signal surveillance, I can't tell where the missile that it's coming because it's not sending a signal out. I can't tell where its fire is coming from because he's not transmitting any signals. And I can't tell its ballistic pattern because it's not flying a ballistic trajectory. So even counter battery radar, when I try to turn that on to detect where this missile is coming from, all I do is send out another signal up about myself that an enemy SST can, up there's his counter battery, and fire another missile at that. And then another missile who's flying kind of nape in the earth comes up at the last second, gets a visual on the targeting site, whether it's, again, an enemy tank platoon, a counter battery radar, and then guides itself right into whatever the system that it's attacking is. So it's really the combination of this thing. You can't detect it ballistically. You can't really detect it electromagnetically. You it's basically invisible. And the other half of this, if we put the missile kind of, if we, you know, table that for a second, we talk about proliferation of ISR, where even you can go to Walmart and get, a UAV type thing with a camera on it, and they're everywhere now. So you have guys that can look, and again, just total proliferation of ISR, basic direction finding capability that you and me could go to Radio Shack and get. So we're going to be dealing with guys that can, how do you hide a tank battalion or a mechanized battalion coming forth? And when an enemy that detects that can engage it with missiles that are basically undetectable for where they're being fired from. And the length of these missiles, some 25 kilometers, some are 60 kilometer variants. So again, put yourself at main side if you're the one with these missiles, and then put the attacker in the northern corridor. You can use any corridor on 29 Palms. And how do you get a mechanized tank battalion through 29 Palms corridors without getting observed, and then without getting these missiles launched at it from who knows where?
All right. So, and so we're talking about peer-to-peer or near peer-to-peer, high end of the spectrum fighting. Yes.
Yeah, I think so, but that's the crazy part is even if you look at the ALAS, I think it's called the last, I want to say sum it up like that, variant that's UAE and Serbia are putting it together. So I wouldn't even consider them necessarily near peers, but if you were to give them 500 of these missiles or 1,000 of these missiles, and then we were to put an army army tank corps going at them, it would still be very problematic for the army tank corps. Again, how do you, no matter all these assets, whether it's, I keep using the word tanks, but even artillery, you fire your artillery round at me, basic counter battery radar, the first time I take a volley, I turn on my counter battery radar, I get a point of origin, even if it's within a few hundred meters or even a kilometer, and I just lob one of these missiles your way, fly low, and then when I get within a kilometer or two of it, kind of bring it up, look at the, observe with thermals or HD imagery. Yep, there's artillery battery. And so who knows how long that would take, 3-4 minutes from the time you fire your first round till the time you're taking an incoming salvo of these fiber optic guided missiles is kind of, again, the overall theory. I know I'm jumping around a lot there.
No. I'm tracking you. Talk to me about now the bicycle. Okay. Talk to me about the bicycle. Give me the logistics of the bicycle, or do you want to talk about that? I understand the mobility piece. Okay. I don't understand flat tires. I don't understand. So the battalion's going to have, all the support that goes with the bicycles. And then talk to me about that mobility piece.
So with the bicycle piece, the thing I kind of overreaders on the overall article is like, how do you logistically support yourself? If I'm telling you, hey, MTVRs are gone, military Humvees are gone, because again, if an observer, they're just going to get targeted too easily.
Right.
Well, how do you get a light infantry unit? How do you move them 10, 20, 30 miles and still support them with the logistics, which is a big piece of this whole pie I need to support. A quick answer is you kind of use the concept of Napoleonic divisions where he takes his corps and divides them up into like units that can actually live off the land and, you know, France and, you know, Western and Central Europe. So he determines what's the amount of guys that can physically move through this mobility corridor and still live off the land. And I think it's similar to that. Like, what is the size of light infantry units that can live off of whatever particular environment we're in? And then to allow them to move more freely in larger distances, what I think the concept is that you use bicycles for that. And if you can ride them, great. But even if you can't ride them, pushing a bicycle with along with all your equipment in tow, either strapped to the back of the bicycle or physically on a cart being towed behind the bicycle, that's much easier than trying to haul this your stuff like long 20, 30 mile distances. So that's kind of the overall purpose is you're using this to move more massive amounts of weight and support yourself with extra things like larger radios that can transmit, you know, larger distances and heavier batteries. And you're using it to generally get over those like large lengthened lines of communication into the next piece of restricted terrain where you can kind of go there and own that and start the fight to either defend from there or whatever the next engagement looks like. So we kind of thought bicycles are about as complicated as you can get. I think most Marines, or at least, you know, 50% of the Marines that can come in, something that's broken on a bicycle, they generally have the know-how to be able to fix it. And again, with a bicycle, if the crankshaft or something breaks, your worst case scenario just kind of turns into a two-wheeled cart, which is good. Whereas anything with a motor, whether that's electric or motorized, when that breaks, it requires, you know, next level like echelon of maintenance, and it's not going anywhere. It's just too heavy to be pushing along with you. So that's kind of where bicycles were about what we, myself and Lieutenant Jones, now Captain Jones, saw as the technology that about as advanced as you could get and kind of sustain by yourself.
All right. Now a lot of people will hear this and they'll chuckle, right? Because bicycle infantry is something that that we've read about in, I believe, on infantry, and so why do you think this is a serious enough issue to write about? Because again, people will look at it and go, yeah, whatever, you know the doom and gloom we've heard about, you know, the battlefield is going to be, you know, it's going to be spacemen and all the rest of the stuff, but that doesn't seem to be happening. It seems like we're getting more and more, we go almost back in time a little bit, to before even the bicycle. Talk to me about that.
So I think that the bicycle, again, you have these guys, when you ask like, hey, what are the chances? I wrote this in the 21st century article. When I ask you, hey, what are the chances that you'll need bicycles in the future to be able to sustain logistical movement? It goes to the different biases that a guy named Daniel Kahneman writes about, in Thinking Fast and Slow. So you replace that question in your head with, hey, what do I think the chances of like the character of war changing that significantly while I'm still in the Marine Corps? And so we do these little sleight of hand question swaps in our own mind without realizing it when we don't, because we don't want to, like, for somebody to ask themselves that question, what are the chances we're going to need bicycles? Like, that's a lot of, brain power and processing and what Kahneman calls system two thinking to do an evaluation of, like, what are the upcoming evolving technologies? What are the geopolitical circumstances that we're going to be dealing with, where there's going to be battles along what type of terrain and what types of avenues of approach. It's just a really complicated question. So ironically, when a lot of guys are asked, like, what are the chances of using bicycles? What they're really doing is a quick mental sleight of hand where they're just asking, like, hey, what do I think the chances of war changing in the next 10 years are? And they're not really ever answering the question in your head. So going back to kind of your original question is, it's tied into the other article is like, well, what are the chances of enhanced fiber optic guided missiles being like a thing in the future with kind of like you're talking about spacemen? And the answer is like, Israel used one in 1998 to kill a Hezbollah leader, and that one was fired from a helicopter, and the missile was fired. They used the optics in the missile to observe the license plate and confirm that that was the correct car with the key leader getting into it, and then with that same camera on the missile, like, flew the missile into the actual vehicle, and that was almost two decades ago. So when we're using the word, like, space technology, futuristic, is this going to happen? A lot of guys, when I talk about this, well, hey, I don't think we have the technology to...
No, the technology, like, I don't think the technology is, can it do it, is a question. It certainly isn't for me, because, I mean, look, we've had tow missiles on fiber-guided optical stuff around for a long, long time. The question would be the proliferation of it, because what we're seeing now is we're seeing ourselves, watched by drones. We're seeing ordnance, hand grenades being dropped by drones, and that stuff that's already happening. It's off the shelf technology, and our adversaries live that life. If you look at pictures of Mosul here recently, there's camouflage nets strung across blocks, right, so they can walk in the street. And the idea isn't to completely conceal themselves, although they're partially concealed. The object is to degrade the imagery enough so that we can't whack them, okay? So that just became a safe place because you erected either a captured camouflage net or you strung together a bunch of sheets and you put that over the street. So now our imagery is degraded to the point where we can't identify friend or foe, which means we can't engage, which means that's a safe place. So the reality of what our foes, even currently in Syria, experience, drives them in this direction. The question is the proliferation of it, because those weapons aren't cheap. The fiber optics thing isn't cheap. And then how they can proliferate. Talk to me about, let me read you a quick email. Hey, Mac, I've heard the bicycle thing before. I always thought it laughable. However, I do believe, though, the march of technology, from Civil War, smokeless gunpowder, to open order tactics, to dispersion, to artillery, not simply as a direct fire weapon, but also an indirect fire weapon. This is the march of time and technology. Although I do seriously question the bicycle thing, because I just don't know that you can sustain those things for use over and over again, and I think they would quickly be discarded. I don't see an era in history where I've seen an elite military organization use these things for a sustained period of time. So let me let you talk about that. Can you give us a historical example of when a military organization has used these for an extended period of time? And again, my guest is today is Major John Kivlin, infantry officer of the United States Marine Corps. We're doing the Marine Corps Gazette Hour, and the issue that we're talking about is light infantry problems and bicycle-borne solutions. So is there a time in history when these things were used by an elite military for a sustained period of time?
There was. I think it's the, if I remember correctly, the pronunciation is Brenal. There was a raid in Brenal where some of the British Royal Marines, I want to say they were Royal Marines, I could be wrong, but either way, the British did an attack on a German radar station where they were trying to get technology from the radar station, and they used that by infiltrating, I don't remember the exact distance off the top of my head, but it was miles away from the actual radar station. Then they used bicycles to move swiftly to the actual the station. They got the piece, and then they used bicycles to get back down to the shore where I believe they left their bicycles, got on Royal Navy ships, and then got out there with the technology. So, ironically, with the question is, mostly special forces are the guys that do use these. It's the conventional forces that have kind of steered away from that. And I think there's a good reason for that too. If you buy into the generational warfare model, which I know drives a lot of people, some people hate it, some people, swear by it, But if you think of second generation warfare as the culmination of where mass conscription meets industrial revolution and the ability to produce these, all these weapons and these deadly capabilities. And if you mix that together, it makes just a super large deadly force, but it doesn't really have that kind of mobility. Then we transition from there to the third generation of warfare, which is where we finally are able to get strategic penetration into the territory. And really, my personal opinion, maybe I read this somewhere, maybe I didn't, I can't remember, is that really it's the transmission is what allows third generation warfare. And if you look historically at the Civil War, guys have been trying to maneuver and outmaneuver each other, but unfortunately, the other guy fills a bunch of railroad cars with tens of thousands of soldiers, moves them 25 or 100 miles in one direction, offloads them, and the strategic penetration's basically plugged up 10, 15 miles later, and then you can create salients that are vulnerable there. So finally, when we perfect the transmission, we are able to, and in this case, the Germans are able to use that to their advantage. And a lot of people think it's laughable. Hey, you can't penetrate that far behind enemy lines. You'll be cut off and swallowed up. And even the most senior leadership in the German army is borderline like terrified the whole time that they're pushing towards the west coast there, all the way up into the name of the bay right there? It slipped my mind right now. Dunkirk. As the Germans are pushing to Dunkirk using this new technology that's the transmission, and they've put their guys on it. So the question now is, going back to kind of both articles together, if the transmission becomes too vulnerable because it's too easy to observe and target, like, are we willing to go back to a second generational model where mobility becomes very difficult because really weapons and people are too deadly and anything that moves that quick is too easily targeted or just doesn't really exist. So we're at like this kind of fork in the road where we got to try to decide, do we want to try to, are we slipping back into a second generational warfare model? Again, if you buy the generational warfare models, or are we going to abandon maneuver when maneuver becomes too dangerous and too vulnerable? Or are we going to try to figure out like how do we maneuver? How do I get light infantry, very quickly through open areas where they can be easily targeted? But in a way that they're not super observable. And by that, I mean, I can see a convoy and hear a convoy of trucks that are glowing hot on thermals, miles and miles away. Like any observer, even an untrained observer, knows when the convoy is passing them. So that is, bicycles, I think, are something that allow us to continue that maneuver warfare model. I don't think to the extremes that we're doing it right now. This is a big question that I still owe a lot more analysis on with.
Okay, so I'll ask you a final question. Let's just say I buy all of it, but it still sounds to me, even for a light infantry unit, I can't be rolling around with bikes and still, accomplish most of my light infantry tasks. Is it a specialty item that I roll out when I need it, use it, and then I'm off again? My S4 supporting me that way? Talk to me.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think that, again, a lot of the confusion where people find it laughable, people think of these bicycles that are carried along with you in the attack, but that's almost as absurd as me saying you're 110 pounds for the TNR manual that you need to carry in your main pack. Like, if I was to tell you to go assault range 400 with a 110-pound assault pack, so everybody would find that laughable as well. I mean, some people already find it laughable that we do it with our full PPE and sappy blades weighed down with the extra 55 to 75 pounds per Marine. But when you think of bicycles don't go in the assault with you. They're left at the attack position. So generally they would be used to move larger distances in the way that like 7 tons or our traditional transportation is currently used. They're not something that you're rolling along down a wash system in range 400 with you. So when you think of them kind of like you're talking about, whether the S4 provides them or whether the S4 doesn't provide them, and they're kind of assigned to a company as in to substitute for the supply system in a traditional battalion, because again, if you buy the other thesis, like that your supply section doesn't have 7 tons or Humvees to deliver those kind of massive quantities of equipment and water and ammunition that that they used to be able to, because again, that stuff just becomes too easily targeted with even like you were saying earlier in the program, like ISIS is already able to do this, and any kid with a grand who can go to Walmart can basically become his own observer with his own UAS. So that's really what the problem I'm trying to crack there with the bicycles.
All right.
By no means do I think that bicycles should be used. If you can use 7-ton and Humvee support to get guys someplace, I'm not saying like, oh no, we don't need that stuff. Bicycles are more like you don't have to worry about the fuel and stuff. I'm just saying, like, I don't believe that those options are going to be an option in the relatively near future. I believe that, like, silent bicycles with light infantry moving from restricted area or concealed area to concealed area is going to be your only option.
All right. So it's an asset that would be resident in the S4, and inside of that, you would be able to roll this out, use it as necessary, almost like the same way that we use the MU would use. You have Marines devoted to helicopters. You have Marines devoted to Ridge Raiders. You have Marines devoted to Amtraks. You would have, maybe a company, maybe a battalion that would be familiar with the employment of bicycles and therefore increase its mobility. And it would simply be another capability resident someplace.
Yeah, in that model, I would almost say the bicycles would be part of the inventory that the helicopter-borne guys are employing, so that when the helicopter sets them down, they can move a longer distance than they normally would be able to. So I think it's tandem with the helicopter-borne stuff, or maybe, I don't know about the Zodiac-type stuff, but...
Right. No, my analogy was not paired with those, but it's another piece of mobility that you would look to.
It's the follow-on piece of mobility for those types of things. Yeah, for
all
sure.
All right, so what's the next article going to be?
Okay, so... I have two articles, one of which I'm working on and one of which should come out in June. And the first one is it's on the integration of simulation technology into all of our stuff. And basically, the theory is that the new PEC that comes out should have the ability to transmit data so that we could kind of integrate our ITES. Are you familiar with ITES or the old Miles gear?
Why don't you explain to everybody so everybody understands?
So currently, when I want to do force-on-force simulation training, I have to go down to a contractor in a warehouse, and I have to take a day or so to issue and then a few hours of another day to try to train the Marines on how to, like, bolt this stuff on and how to wear the vests and all the sensors. And really, the big sticking point seems to be when you put the little laser on the front of your weapon, sometimes it's off or it's not accurate or just doesn't seem to fire right, or the Marines aren't paying attention because they're human and Marines will do what Marines do. And so kind of what I'm saying is we should kind of make it a Marine Corps policy where unless you get approval from the Commandant to deviate from this, every piece of technology that comes out should have the ability to integrate into simulation systems without having to go bolt a whole bunch of other stuff on or to do that, so that Marines can do force-on-force training with little to no support at all. And the big thing that it would rotate around are like the PEC, the new PEC version, whatever, let's call it the PEC 17 that comes out,
right,
would have the ability to, when you shot, it's already got the two lasers, so making a laser rangefinder function, I don't think would be a far cry from the capability. And if you really look at the other stuff you need to put in there to get this thing to transmit, mid distances, and by that I mean a mile or two to a transmitter, that technology already exists in an iPhone 3 that we could have gotten, 7 to 10 years ago. The ability to have a basic GPS function, the ability to have to be able to measure azimuths and angles, the ability to do kind of Bluetooth and link into short stuff in the media area, and then the actual cell capability to be able to go hit a cell repeater tower. So if you were basically combined the technology from an iPhone 3, the technology from a PEC 16, I think with maybe a few little tweaks on and microchips in there and some programming, you would be able to create a device that acted as an eye test sensor. Same thing for mortars, get something similar on there. So again, and you were at the basic school as an instructor as well. I don't know how you guys did it, but for us, it's like trying to paint the effects of mortars hitting the enemy position. You kind of like fairy dust. Oh yeah, hey, you're receiving mortars 100 meters that way. Whereas if this was the case, these Marines are linked into a program, or they're linked into a local tower, a local control unit. I think I called it the master simulation control unit. And, their systems are hitting that similar to the way your cell phone hits a tower. And you have a mortar section and support. And when they call for fire, that the mortar guys get the message via radio. They put the data on the guns, and whatever the guns say they're pointing at and the azimuth, even if whether it's a fake dummy round, or whether, you know, we'd have to iron that out. But when they drop a dummy round in the mortar tube, it strikes the pin and it sends the data for whatever's on the gun. And then it calculates the position of that gun and where the round would have landed. And the lieutenants or, you know, the Marines, the squad leaders, they get actual real life, like, hey, this is what would have, no shit, happened if you were to do that call for fire mission, as opposed to an instructor who's just like, yeah, you got good effects, go. So all the technology that we have would be able to integrate into this like very basic system that would just use, you know, basic geometry, basic GPS positions, and kind of do the math. Similar to the way it already does it, except for you wouldn't have to go waste 2 days on the front end and a day on the back end to go deal with contractor support. And then if your PEC 17 is BZO the way it should be in combat, that same laser that would normally cause you to kill an enemy combatant is the same laser that would on force. So if you're able to do it and get your no shit rounds on target, your force on force rounds would also be on target. So kind of a little bit of redundancy there. Train like we fight and fight like we train.
Got it. All right. And when's that going to be out?
That should be out in the June article or June edition of the Gazette.
Got it. All right. First of all, we appreciate your time again. And again, thanks for doing this again this week. And my guest, Major John Kivlin, United States Marine Corps, and a smart guy, a writer, obviously, and a forward thinker. So, John, hope you don't mind if in the future I bug you and have you back on.
No, absolutely. Anytime you want to have me on the show, I'd love to be on.
Okay, bud. Thank you for doing this on Marine Corps Gazette Wednesday. Appreciate it.
All right, great for me. Thanks for having me on. We'll talk in a bit.
Not a problem. That is John Kivlin, Major, United States Marine Corps. Yeah, you know, a lot of people, you know, poo-poo stuff like that. And you hear those, you know, bicycle infantry and all the rest of the stuff. The question is, where does it fit? What does it cost? When you mount it out, how wide is the application? And if its premise is correct, then the application probably is not far off the mark. You know, and so what happens is, obviously people beat up the premise. Hey, I'm not buying it. I don't see it. That'll do it. My thanks to Boomer Milstead for coming on. You'll hear this that interview coming up here in a few minutes. Interesting stuff, and his comments relative to zero tolerance. My thanks to Major John Kivlin for being patient this morning. We were a little late getting to him on Wednesday when we do Marine Corps Gazette stuff. So have a great day. Tomorrow we'll talk transition. Hopefully Kate Germano will join us, and we'll talk about the Marines United and the Marine response and what it should be. I'll read you one more email relative to that. Mac, I'm listening, and it's almost like we keep going over the same thing over and over again. Is the task of the Marine Corps to reinvent our society or to hold people accountable for it? Question mark. Sometimes the things I hear people say, it's like they want the world to be upside down all of a sudden. I don't know that the Marine Corps has that luxury. I think the best you can do is lay the wood to people. Considering for the Marine Corps that you have a very short period of time with 60% of your force, a single enlistment, and they're gone. What will you teach them after 18 years of living on the planet or more? What will you teach them? How quickly will they assimilate to it before they're gone? The bottom line for the Marine Corps is it will deal with what it gets. People that reenlist and go beyond a single term, that's a different issue. You have greater time with them. They will go to school repeatedly, and you will get a chance to change them. But I think, and then in parentheses, it was surprising to hear the numbers too, by the way. I didn't realize the Marine Corps was that young. If you think with first-term enlistees that you were going to change their DNA and the society that they came from, you are crazy. That will not happen. The best you can do is hold them accountable after you publicize the standard. To that end, I do believe that a specific article relative to this kind of stuff would be a good thing. And one could argue that the UCMJ doesn't specifically need it, but that wouldn't be my argument. The young people that come into our military need it. They need that kind of specificity and clarity. Enjoy the program. I agree with others. Don't hear this discussion very often. Appreciate you entertaining it. How we relate to each other, how we do it. It's certainly a daunting task. An organization that is 94% male and comes from our current society, to try to turn those into functioning young adults is no small task. And from what I read relative to the Commandant's testimony, less than 500 people access his website. What percentage of those will be active duty Marines? Good question. I guess we'll all learn a lot here in a very short period of time. Enjoy the program. All right, there you have it. Yeah, good question. Good question. Stay tuned. On a Wednesday, All Marine Radio. Have a great afternoon. Out.